Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 521, Science Faction, The Return of Cerruti.
The Return of Cerruti. This is good. Bobby, you know my respect towards your profession is, I don't give it a lot of lip service. Let me put it that way.
Sure.
But the drama that you, your profession, and Mr. Cerruti have brought to this show and the science world is to be commended, sir.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Cerruti was just the guy who discovered. He also passed away last year. He wasn't the one who I, disagree with as much, though I do, obviously, from his findings as well. But he wasn't really the author of any of the papers around it and stuff. It's just named after him. We will get into discussion of exactly what this is about and who I have disagreements with. But he is the late Mr. Cerruti.
Fresh and fruity. May he rest in international hops in peace.
Speaking of resting in peace, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
I am doing great. And I completely forgot that these episodes, these regular non-I call BS episodes, the ones that are available to all, for all.
Yes. The people's episodes.
Yes. We're supposed to be working a little less blue.
Yes, slightly less brew. So you take those IHOP references out. You know this is a Denny's franchise show.
International, Damon. Are you saying you support socialism? Is that what you're saying?
And Mexicans.
Wow. Listen, we're an American company. Come on, guys. We're housed in Cleveland.
And thank you to all of our patrons who are supporting us. It is fantastic to see you guys doing it. I want to thank every one of you guys, and I want to remind all of you guys that are patrons already that your first mailer is coming out with your first bag of goodies that's coming out this month. So if you haven't already gotten me your stuff on Patreon, if you don't check your Patreon email a lot, make sure you send me your address so I can send that stuff out. And if you are one of those people who are kind of thinking about signing up for Patreon, you think it's a good idea, but you're waiting or whatever, I'm just going to let you know now, no pressure. But the first bag of goodies does go out this month, so you gotta sign up within the next week or so to get on that first mailing list where you get the free KN95 respirators, where you get the bag of stickers, where you're gonna get a couple of goodies from us. And that's kind of a one-time deal that we'll kind of send that stuff out later on, but this is the only time you're really gonna get all the sweet free stuff. So like, if you were ever thinking about it, now is prime time to take advantage of it. Oh, and by the way, you get all the I Call BS. We now are going to have 4 back episodes of I Call BS you'll get to enjoy. You will sit there and binge on science. And I want to thank, as we said, we're going to thank our patrons, each and every one of them, no matter how long it takes. We're only going to do 3 people per main episode because you guys deserve that. So thank you so much to Alessia Rowan.
Alessia Rowan. We're going to stop and pause. Uh-huh. We're going to pay homage to each one. If we're doing less, I think
sure.
They've earned something. Alessia Rowan, this is Copernicus. And let me just say... I wish we had more science fighters. Damien doesn't understand. I'll explain it to him later. Like you. And less science fighters like Damien.
Oh, man. I wish Damien could get it as well as Copernicus does.
Copernicus.
You know who else gets it? Is Erica Durham. Erica, thank you very much.
Erica Durham, this is Alex Jones here, and I want to say I completely respect what you're doing. Between your funding of Science Faction is actually going towards re-sexual education therapy for frogs that have been turned gay by municipal water supplies. So thank you. Conversion therapy works.
And lastly, our biggest contributor, the Sultan of Science Faction Patreons, Chris Waltrip. Chris, you are a mensch. And by the way, Chris is one of those people who signed up for the package where he will actually get to guest star on one of our Thursday episodes. So Chris, I'll set that up with you, and that'll be really fun.
I am sorry, Chris. It is Patreon who has to greet you. I look forward to trying to seduce you when we record an episode. Patreon is trained to make love in over 4 positions.
Over 4? Wow.
4 and a half.
I want to thank these people for keeping our show going and for allowing us to get the equipment needed so that we can eventually bring back scientists before this quarantine ends. And when it does end, that we can finally bring back our studio. So thank you guys so much. I have not taken a dime out of this Patreon. I have no intent to do so anytime soon. I am using this 100% for improving the show. So these people are literally funding the future of Science Faction, whether it's hosting fees or if we eventually do advertising. But right now, hard stuff like microphones and laptops and mailing stuff out to scientists so that they can participate.
That is actually not true. Bobby does convert this money to cash briefly just so he can throw it upon himself and roll it into a bed. But then it goes right back into a fund that is then reinvested into the show.
Yes, unless anything, like any bills actually stick to my body, which I refer to as sticky money, and those are keepsies.
Those turn into pot magically.
All right, let's go right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Article number one, Saruti's return.
Oh no, run. Put the kids inside. Get the town guard.
So those of you guys who have been listening long enough might recognize that name. It is a long storied tale on Science Faction. We've covered this since the very beginning of publication in a heavily detailed and some may say scrutinized way.
Can you give us the 90-second version?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about this a little bit. We're going to talk about the history of the Saruti site, my involvement in it, Science Faction's involvement in it, the archaeological community's involvement in it, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a new article about this site that came out this week, and that is what we will discuss at the end, but let me do a quick review. So this site was found in 1992 by Richard Saruti, who was a paleontologist, not an archaeologist, for the Natural History Museum, and it was...
Fresh and fruity.
It was a mastodon site along Highway 54. Actually, ironically, almost equidistant from between where Damien and I grew up, like the spot of the Saruti mastodon site right along Highway 54.
If a mastodon was on that site, he would have gone to our high school.
Yes, and been mugged because it was just the national city border.
It was a crime-filled time, the 90s.
So this was found in 1992. It was the fossil remains of a mastodon. They did not know the age yet, but it would later be determined to be about 130,000 years old by optical luminescence dating. And there were some weird parts about how the skeleton was accumulated that caught Richard's attention. First of all, the femoral heads, those balls that fit into your hip joint, they were broken off and found together. Not super weird because they tend to roll. This was on the banks of a kind of slow-moving stream, so probably not necessarily directly impacted, but they could have rolled or gotten there in a lot of ways, so that isn't necessarily weird. But what he did find was two bashed open, as he put it, parts of the skeleton. One was a bashed open part of actual bone, and the other was a bashed open tooth, and some cobble rocks nearby that he believed bashed them open. And his
idea... Is that the science word, bash? Was that the word, like, quote-unquote bash?
Absolutely.
Is he British? Because like it's classier if he's British. I get it.
It's also the science word for a party.
That's a monster mash, I believe you're referring to.
No, that is not a scientific word.
No, Damien, we're referring to a graveyard bash.
It caught on as a flash. So he saw this and he said, this looks like humans modified it. Now, again, Saruti was not an archaeologist. He's a paleontologist. He saw this. The Natural History Museum came. They did some excavation. They did a brief write-up in the report that came out in the, I think, 94 or 95. Nothing really jumped off as it being particularly special. But Saruti felt that it was signs of ancient human occupation. Now, to understand why this is, you have to go back a bit. Now, Saruti was not a classically trained paleontologist, didn't have some like big fancy degree, no PhD or anything like that. But he was heavily influenced by a guy named George Carter, who was an archaeologist working under the godfather of San Diego archaeology, Malcolm Rogers. And now we're talking about the first half of the 20th century, so pretty old. And because it was that old, it was before radiometric dating. And George Carter would frequently find things that he insisted were signs of occupation that date back, you know, 60 to 100,000 years. And his mentor, Malcolm Rogers, were like, no, dude,
that's just a used condom in the parking lot, bro. That's
It's like the 50s. I don't think anybody had condoms. I think it's just a free-for-all.
What type of queer individual would use a condom, I say?
And he would, you know, find stuff and think that it was a sign of ancient occupation. It eventually ended up becoming the cause of a rift between the two of them, a mentor and mentee, so to speak. And George Carter continued publishing about, you know, kind of nutty theories for a long time. And Richard Cerruti was a George Carter adherent and a fan. And he also believed there was signs of ancient human occupation of the Americas. This was also, you got to remember, both when Richard was saying this and George was saying this 5 decades ago or 4 decades ago when they were learning this stuff, this was before we had the genetics we now know of Native American tribes that tell us when they did diverge from the other groups and that it was only about 35,000 years ago or so and that they were, you know, isolated in Beringia for 10,000 of those years and stuff. So they didn't come in until 25,000 years ago at the very earliest, probably something around there, 25, 30, something. You could make a case for something like that, but really not much earlier than that. We know that now from the genetic data, and they didn't know that. They also didn't have great radiometric dating back then, and so they didn't have tons and tons of C14 samples that all kind of culminate at, you know, back then it was culminating at like 10,000 years. Now they can go back to about 15,000 years. They didn't have all of that, and there was this big idea that humans or some kind of hominid had been in the Americas for a long time. That has essentially been debunked, or for the most part, there's no evidence of it, I guess you could say.
Except for Sasquatch, the skunk ape.
At some point, Richard wrote it up in some obscure, like, Chariots of the Gods type pseudoscience book. Like, yeah, I got this site that looks like an archaeological site in San Diego. It's, you know, I think at the time he thought it was like 300 or 800,000 years old. He thought it was really old. And he wrote it up in some kind of obscure book. And by the way, that should tell you something. The fact that he decided that, A, this parse evidence and everything was evidence of this great claim, and that he put it in a pseudoscience book.
No, people who self-publish are usually the best writers. They have was just too good to be picked up by a major publisher.
Fast forward to 2008, when a fringe archaeologist, Dr. Stephen Holland, he does have a PhD in archaeology, but he also has a bunch of unsubstantiated fringe claims of early occupation of the Americas, was reading one of those nutty books. Again, something should tell you that he was reading through these pseudoscience books, came across it and contacted the Natural History Museum and Richard Cerruti and the head of that Natural History Museum, Tom Demaray, to say, hey, I want to be involved in this. I want to check this out. Now, the site was already covered because they had already done the work that they had done on the freeway 16 years beforehand, but he came and looked at their quote-unquote artifacts and the paleontological materials that they had at the Natural History Museum. He went, yep, this is it. We definitely have the smoking gun. Human beings were in the Americas a long time ago, and he started writing stuff up. A year later, there's about 2009-ish, I was working directly with Richard at an area in Point Loma, and he happened to mention offhand, hey, I got a site in San Diego that's, at the time, I think he thought it was like 500,000 years old. And he's like, I got a site that's 500,000 years old. Me being a young field archaeologist was like, holy shit, here in San Diego, you got to tell me. I want to be the guy who breaks this story. This is so interesting. He's like, yeah, we got a team working on it. This is going to be the biggest news that ever hit science.
I'll tell you about it, but you got to call me Richard. My name's not Dick.
Now, some things you should know about Richard. He's a good field paleontologist, but he does have a streak of nuttiness to him. Like he's like,
that wasn't a good pause you had. Like if I was Richard and I was listening to that, I was like, oh, I don't like that pause.
Anybody who knew him would say this. I'm not saying this derogatorily. Anybody who knew him would be like, you know what they would say if they were really, really nice? They'd be like, that guy was unique. That's what they would say.
He's a scientist?
Yeah. And again, not necessarily classically trained, but a decent paleontologist and stuff. And he had some ways of thinking that were a little nutty. Anyway, so he tells me this at a job we're at in 2009, and I'm flipping out. I'm like, bro, I got to see everything. I want to be a part of this. And he's like, oh, yeah, totally. Okay. And so after begging him and begging him, one day he just shows up with this, you know, inch thick file and hands it to me. And at the time, we're monitoring some construction, so we have off time.
This is what they don't want you to see.
Yeah, basically.
Oh my God.
I stand there and read through this thing excitedly, like a little kid on Christmas. Like, this is going to be how I make my mark in archaeology. You know, I'm a young kid at this point. I'm a new archaeologist. I'm so excited. This is the thing I'm going to write my PhD dissertation on. This is going to make me famous, blah, 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 blah. And I start reading it, and like halfway through, I realize there's nothing fucking here. Here's the deal. When we find archaeological sites, there's pretty telltale signs. We have things like flaked stone lithics or flaked tools where it's very obvious that somebody has made a tool, whether that's a projectile point or a bladed knife or something like that.
An extension cord.
Yeah. Or we have the remains of those people, like we have bones that they left when they died, or we have fire hearths that they left when they were cooking something, or if they were cutting up a mastodon, like Richard is saying they did, we have cut marks on the bones. There is none of that. There is none. He basically just says this skeleton was in a weird position. One of the tusks was pushed distal end down into the dirt. These femoral heads were lying around. There were some cobbles around there, and this one bone and this one tooth were smashed. And I was looking at it. I just remember like looking up at some point and being like, Richard, where's the evidence? And he was a little bit taken aback. And he's like, well, look, see how weird all this stuff is? And I was like, yeah, weird does not mean you can suddenly decide that the hominids got to the Americas over 100,000 years earlier than they did. There's no evidence here. Like, what's here? And he's like, well, I've got some pretty big shots who think there is. And so I was like, okay. And I just sat on it. And it became one of those things that kind of would go, you'd hear around in circles in the archaeological community in San Diego. Hey, did you hear about Nutty Old Richard? Not my words. This is what somebody would say. Did you hear about Nutty Old Richard's site? Did you hear about that? And yeah. I've actually read the file on it. It's not very convincing. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I heard it the last time you called him Nutty Richard and told me about this. Yes, I have heard about this, Bobby.
And in 2017, they finally published in Nature. And it was one of the biggest science stories in Nature. It proclaimed that they had evidence that there were hominids in the Americas at 130,000 years, because then they had done the optical luminescence dating, got at a date of 130,000 years ago, who, you know, had come and smashed open this mastodon skeleton, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a few things. One, everybody went, oh, Nature, like the gold standard of scientific publishing. They didn't publish an article in Nature. They published a letter in Nature, which is something that you do to kind of announce a discovery or something like that. It's not a super detailed thing. It was 5 pages long.
I've read the letters to Penthouse, and yeah. They're usually not the most informative part of the magazine.
Dear Nature, so I was on this hot and sexy site when all of a sudden, what did I see? A hard bone.
And the field tech holding it had an equally hard body. Cha-ching, I thought. Looks like there's a lot of bones at this site.
I read the Nature paper, and I was immediately, like, taken aback. I was like, oh, my God, because all of a sudden, all the news stories, they don't know that it's bullshit. They hear a PhD archaeologist, and the paleontologist who co-wrote it was the head of the Natural History Museum, is publishing a quote-unquote paper, even though it was a letter, in Nature. It must be true, right? And so all these science articles are coming out about, you know, taking the date of human occupation of the Americas back 100,000 plus years, et cetera, et cetera. Myself, and by the way, the entire archaeological community immediately responded. There were numerous archaeologists who started publishing rebuttals. Hey, you don't have any evidence. This isn't good, blah, 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 blah. The problem was a lot of their rebuttals were also kind of bullshit because they were claiming, well, this must have happened. These rocks probably, you know, fractured it because of construction and stuff. But these rocks and some of the bones they fractured had what's called pedagogic crust on it. They had basically a clay crust that had formed on the outside of it that takes at least millennia, at least a few thousand years. And freeway construction in that area started in like the 50s. So like it was not enough time to cause that. So like their rebuttals weren't always so great either. But regardless, the archaeological community came out and said, you have nothing. This is not at all convincing. This is a fringe theorist working with a non-formally trained paleontologist with a bad hypothesis and zero evidence.
He's nutty. We've all heard he's nutty, right? All of us have heard.
Making huge claims that are not backed up by the science there. And I was so interested in this that I decided that this would be, you know, similar to what I decided with Richard in 2009. I decided that this is going to be kind of my swan song. And this is what I wrote my master's thesis on. My master's thesis, which, by the way, ended up being more than 20 times longer than their letter to Nature. So it was a fairly in-depth discussion, not only of their evidence, but of the other evidence that is around it in the community about the genetic evidence for the occupation of the Americas. And, oh, by the way, I went back and I found out that they were like, well, look, what is it? It's either this is a one in a million paleontology site that otherwise we can't explain, or it's an archaeology site. And I went back and found that no, it's actually a fairly typical paleontology site for proboscideans, elephant-like creatures. This is just what happens naturally. In fact, we find sites exactly like this dating back 25 million years before hominids exists, like long, long time ago. And so no, this has nothing to do with hominids. There's these natural ways this could happen. Specifically, other elephants or other mastodons, mammoths, etc., trampling the bones of this thing. We know that modern day elephants revisit the bones of their dead. They pick them up, they trample them, they step on them. We have evidence that this has been going on with other proboscideans all the way back 25 million years. It is a very easy explanation. They trampled it. And by the way, a bunch of things don't fit. Where did these hominids come from? How come we have no evidence of them for the 100,000 plus years they had to live here on these continents? How come they didn't leave any bones, any stone tools? How come they, when they were at this place, they didn't start any fires? Hey, how do you even remove the skin and meat off of a mastodon without cutting it and leaving cut marks. It's not even possible. Your idea that they're pushing this tusk in the ground is silly. You know what can do that? A giant elephant. You know what can't do it? A person. And nor would they. It doesn't look like any proboscidian processing site we have either in the Americas later on or earlier, 130,000 years ago, in Eurasia, where that stuff was going on. They never did any of this stuff. So none of that made sense. Oh, and by the way, their response to there's no cut marks on the bones was, yeah, they're using it as a bone quarry, meaning they're smashing open these bones to get at the marrow or to make tools
Love
out of them.
To it.
No, or to make tools out of the bone material. Here's the problem. And I still to this day don't know how this got published without anybody pointing this out to them, as I later pointed out in my thesis. They have one bone smashed and one tooth smashed, a molar. There is no marrow in molars.
And they found that out right then and there.
So they weren't trying to get to the marrow. Oh, and by the way, they have all of the pieces of the tooth. They have a complete refit, meaning they didn't take anything away to make tools either. So why were they smashing? They literally have a hypothesis that doesn't even make sense to explain the site that doesn't have evidence for the thing they claim. It is crazy. Oh, and we know what people were doing at that time with things like bone quarrying sites. Not only were they smashing all the long bones, which they did not, but they were doing things like boiling that to make bone grease, which you can still get nutrition out of, and they did not do that with these. So again, there is no evidence pointing to this being an ark site, a bunch of evidence pointing to it not being an ark site, and you have to get over the impossibility of the fact that no hominids made it to the Americas that we can tell for at least another 100-some-odd thousand years. All right, so anyway, a new paper was released just this week. It's the first major publication since I published my thesis in early 2019. And in this, they claim, one of the original researchers who did some lithic works claims that he has evidence of bone-like material on some of the stones. And so all of the reports are coming out. Oh, look, they've confirmed it. Look, they got more evidence saying that it's human-made and stuff. A few things about this. Number one, it is possible bone residue on two of the stones associated with the site. And it is no collagen, which we would expect if something was done when the bone was fresh, as opposed to when it was busted up. But even if you were to ignore that and say, I don't know, maybe something happened to the collagen in that point, I actually predicted this in my thesis. I even said, hey, look, maybe sometime later we will find evidence of the bones having been broken on these exact stones. Guess what? That's exactly what would happen during trampling. The elephant or the proboscidian, the mastodon, is coming here, stepping on these bones. They are sitting on these rocks. As they are stepping on it, they are smashing the bones, smashing the molars. Again, there's no other reason to smash a molar. It's nonsensical to smash a molar and have a complete refit. So there's no reason for it to happen unless it's randomly done by another proboscidian. And so it is happening. So even if you had chemical evidence of that on these rocks, which, by the way, I predicted because he had an unpublished paper from 2015 that he never released that suggested that might be there. Even if you had that, still, parsimony, the simplest possible explanation suggests that it is not an archaeological site. It's just a paleontological site, and not even a very, very special one, a pretty average paleontological site.
So it says that in your master's thesis?
Yes.
And we should trust you on this, just like we should trust you on there being literally, as you said, millions of emails complaining about my performance and I call BS?
1.45 million emails a week, Damien, until we stopped doing I Call BS as the main show and we moved it over to, I can show you the absence of the 1.45 million emails since we moved to Patreon. Yeah. I can show you my email box and how there is not 1.45 million emails in there.
All right, well, can we go back and look at your deleted emails?
Do you know how quickly my emails filled up, Damien? You know I had to delete every single week, multiple times a day, just to keep up with
it. Then it should be easy to show me just one of these emails.
Not if I had to delete them all.
How did you get anything done?
That's what I want to know.
You son of a bitch. You piece of shit.
But listen, as I put in my thesis, I'm not saying, listen, there's no possible way. All I'm saying is there is no evidence that this is an archaeological site. They still haven't presented any good evidence of it. And there is way better explanations otherwise. There are things that could change my mind tomorrow. We find a hominid bone near there that dates to the same time period. Boom, my mind has changed. We find flakestone lithics that date to the same. Boom, my mind has changed. A datable fire hearth. My mind has changed. Cut marks on bones. It's very easy. It's just the exact same evidence we'd expect from any legitimate archaeological site. And this is the reason that you need to have a fringe archaeologist to accept this as a thing 16 years after it's discovered and write it up and it gets published, you know, 25 years after it's published. That happens because it's a fringe claim, not because it's a real one. That's not how real claims usually go. So let me just lay out some possibilities that include this new paper in terms of what possibly happened. So there is the Cerruti hypothesis. It represents an archaeological site that is 130,000 years old by some mysterious hominid. We still don't know what it is. It can't be the ancestors of Native Americans. We know they diverged much, much later from everybody else. So it can't be them. It has to be some mysterious hominid. It came here and did that. And by the way, it didn't leave any evidence, didn't manipulate the site in the way any hominids we know would do so, randomly smash a tooth for no reason, left a bunch of other stuff they would like, including the best material there, which was the ivory from the tusks, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that is a possibility. I'm giving it like a 0.05% chance of being likely, but that is a possibility. Possibility number two, this represents a regular paleontological site with trampling done by another mastodon. I think that is far and away the most likely. We have dozens of sites like this all around the world. They have no correlation whatsoever to hominid activity. They go back to before hominids even evolved in Africa. Most likely scenario is that. Number three, this represents a paleontological site in which those bones were smashed by that rock, and it was done by another mastodon. One of the things I explore in my paper is that current day elephants are known to pick up rocks, big, large ones, and use them like tools to do things like knock down electric fences. Well, we know there were mastodons there. We know they can pick up rocks. They could theoretically pick up rocks and smash bones, especially because we know that current day elephants go back, manipulate, play with, and constantly visit the bones of their dead. So we could assume that that's a possibility in the mastodon lineage as well.
We also know that in many respects, a dead elephant mimics an electric fence.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, certainly not functionally or even visually or really.
Well, in that, enough dead elephants will keep your cows from wandering into the road. That's a fact. That is a fact.
I mean, yeah.
And they will also mark the area in which Simba should not go until he is an adult.
It's not for you, Simba. Stay away. Oh my God, the ecological impact of your fence, sir, has been immense.
I don't think that proboscidian manipulation hypothesis is very likely, but it's a possibility, and I still put it as much more likely than the mysterious hominid thing. And lastly, number three, I think this is even less likely than the proboscidian wielding thing, but still more likely than the mysterious hominid one. This could be an archaeological site, but one in which early Native Americans, let's say 15 or 20,000 years ago, stumble upon the remains of a mastodon, which died 130,000 years ago and was partially fossilized, and they then break open the bones and don't find anything and gets reburied. Again, there's no reason for them to be breaking open teeth, but that would have given enough time for it to form that crust and stuff, then got reburied for 20,000 years. So that is still a possibility. I put that as the least likely non-mysterious ancient magic ghost hominid that doesn't leave any remains hypothesis. So there are four hypotheses, and out of them, I believe the Cerruti hypothesis is the least likely. Even given this information, which, you know, some people are touting as a smoking gun. Again, I address this exact scenario in my master's thesis, saying that this literally does not change anything. Of course, if elephants are trampling the bones on top of these stones, we would find the exact same thing.
Okay, so that's the first act. The first act, catching everybody up. Second act, new information. What's the third act? Because I know this is your opus, your project.
Sure.
So how are you writing this wrong? How are you enforcing scientific justice?
In the octagon.
Respect. Because I'm fairly confident that you can take... there aren't a lot of scientists who have the level of boxing and jiu-jitsu training that you have.
Yes, I will get... Yeah, I don't have great jiu-jitsu, but boxing, a decent amount of kickboxing and some judo, and I think that'll suffice. I mean, listen, if I'm going up against the two main authors, they're both in their, like, 60s. I'll take them both on at the same time. I'll take Holland and I'll take Demaray. Let's make this happen.
This is how you lose, Bobby. You get foolish, you make... listen, you're... I agree. You're unlikely to lose against these two 60-year-old men. I'll give you that. But it just seems like an unnecessary mistake, given their affronts to science and the fact that nobody's betting on this. There aren't Vegas odds. You could just beat them up individually.
It's funny you bring up their affronts to science, because I'm about to give them a front kick from hell, if you know what I mean. I have a great front kick. It's like my best kick, so...
They're just going to hit the ground. They're going to be standing one second, on their ass the next.
Oh, dear. Okay, on to article number two. We'll get this done real quick since we're already a bit over time. Is the salmon mystery finally solved?
Why, it's so delicious.
So for the last few decades, something has been killing salmon in the Pacific Northwest. It was especially noticeable after heavy rains when up to 90% of adult salmon would just like suddenly die off. So That was a hint that it might be something that was getting washed into rivers and streams, possibly from nearby roads. We looked everywhere for the past few decades trying to figure out what that could be. Is it pesticides? Is it Kurt Cobain albums being discarded after his death? You know, is it tears of sadness from the mopey grunge community? Like, what could be killing all of these salmon?
I thought it might have just been very clever thinking by bears. Like Yogi Bear discovered, like, oh, boo-boo, if we just poison the river, the fish will come to us. Oh!
That was a much darker Yogi the Bear.
Also, he dies from eating poisoned fish, but yeah. He didn't think this through.
It was like that episode of The Wire where he accidentally gave his friend the poison who died.
Boo-boo, I think your salmon idea. Oh, the ranger. Oh, get him.
Yogi Bear is kind of the Stringer Bell of bears, if you think about it.
Ranger, whatever. He's the Omar. No, nobody's Omar on that show. That show needed an Omar.
So a publication this week might have actually finally solved this decades-long mystery. And the answer, of course, Damien, we were talking about this before. I don't know how we didn't see it before. 6-PPD quinone.
6-PPD quinone. Yeah, you know me. That's been my saying forever. You're speaking my language.
What this is a chemical that is added to tires to keep them from disintegrating more quickly due to ozone. Now, they had found the kind of makeup of 6-PPD after doing a bunch of tests on different stuff in roads, and then basically in the lab, exposing a bunch of salmon to a bunch of different chemicals until one finally died. A ton of work trying to kill a few amount of salmon. It was a lot of salmon killing work. But eventually they found that
the salmon shouting, try cocaine again! Try cocaine again!
They finally found this chemical. They wanted to figure out what it could be used for. They looked it through, you know, tons of old papers and finally found like a 1983 paper from the tire industry that basically said, hey, here's this new chemical, 6-PPD, that we're going to use. We think it's going to help tires hold up a lot longer. And then we found out that it's not only, you know, you don't only have to test the chemicals that people are putting onto the roads. You have to test what they become. So this 6-PPD, when it does combine with ozone to protect those tires, it forms a new chemical called 6-PPD quinone or quinone. I don't know. But it forms that chemical when that chemical, it turns out to be highly lethal to these specific salmon. And so it was a very interesting decades long, like whodunit mystery that you have to kill a lot of salmon. You know what they say? You can't make an omelet without killing a few salmon.
That is what they say. Does this have the same effect on people? Like if I just were to drink a bunch of pond water after a rainstorm in Seattle?
I don't know. I mean, we could start gnawing on tires and see how it works.
Yeah. Or like if you see a dead salmon, don't just think, what a delicious free meal. What would a bear do?
He would shoot Omar.
It's been hard to trust a bear after that show.
Yeah, no, never, never again. And by the way, the debut of a very young and talented Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, way to go. He went on to try to take over Wakanda. Boo.
Ooh, yeah, complicated history there. Anyway, very interesting. I'm sure we'll never actually take those out of tires and we'll just keep doing it. But at least now we know where it comes from. So, you know, who knows what we'll end up doing with that information. Maybe we'll find an antidote to 6-PPD quinone.
Well, I could see a lot of the outdoorsmen, fishermen type people standing up and saying, we need more government regulation to help protect our waterways and environment.
That's why they're all part of the Sierra Club.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, audience, for coming back to Science Faction 521, where you learned all about Saruti's return and the mystery of what's killing the salmon. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back later this week for Science Faction 522.
I tell you, the worst part about the International House of Pancakes ain't even the rooty tooty fish and fruity part. No, it's that they call soccer football.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.